Welcome to Planetary Conversations. I'm your host, Warren Bell. Each week I talk with experienced and knowledgeable guests from all backgrounds and walks of life as we explore ideas and actions that can restore the health of our planet and heal our relations with one another. Check out our website at voiceoftheshoeshop.ca, and you can find all our episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Shukapmakulu, the stolen, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Suquepic people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. Benjamin Franklin once said that there is nothing as certain as death and taxes. However, today, there are very wealthy people who pay no taxes, which leaves death alone in a category by itself. Despite this, in this part of the world, we often avoid considering death as real until it is staring us in the face. We don't discuss it with family and friends. We don't relate to stories in the media on a personal level. And on a practical level, we delay making the necessary arrangements to do with death, even when we're aging and struggling with health issues that might, at some proximate point, bring us to face our own death. It hasn't always been this way. Our ancestors throughout thousands of years have seen death up close far more often than we do in our times. Although grief was always part of the experience of death, death itself was neither a friend nor an enemy. It was simply an integral part of our existence and that of all living things. In many cultures and places around the world, citizens live closer to death than we do in Western industrial society, sometimes because they lack health services, but also because of harsh environments, repressive governments, or sheer poverty. In these settings, death is more familiar and more openly included as part of one's life. But how do we deal with death in this part of the world? Today we have three guests from our own community of Salmon Arm in British Columbia, Canada, who have been directly involved with death in one way or another, and we're going to have a free-flowing conversation about death and matters related to it. Kathy DeMille is a businesswoman who was confronted with a challenging death in her family, challenging not just in itself, but because of some of the ways it was dealt with that in fact led her to become involved with the hospice society locally. Janae Peterson is a practicing registered nurse who has worked in both acute care and long-term care in our community. Especially in the latter setting, death is always near at hand. And Adele Prato is a retired family physician who, during her career and beyond, has seen and cared for people approaching death on many occasions and borne the direct challenge and responsibility of trying to ensure that with medical care, their death is as comfortable as possible. Now, it gives me great pleasure, ladies, to welcome you all into our studio today.
Glad to be here.
Happy to be here. So grateful for the opportunity to speak today.
Yeah, Adele, when we were talking about death before, you immediately said that life is a terminal condition. Yes. Why didn't you just enlarge on it a bit? Because I think it's a kind of an underlying concept that I've kind of made mention of in my introduction.
I think we need to look at death as part of the circle of life, really. Yeah. There is a beginning and there is an end. So in that way, life is a terminal illness because we all will get to that final bridge,
yes,
which is a final bridge.
Yes,
and indeed. We need to be ready. And it's a journey. And I think when we go on a journey, we usually have some sort of plan. But I'm not sure
we
all
do
for life. Yeah.
Yes.
And I think perhaps the worst thing is that the word death, we shun away from it.
Yeah.
We just don't like talking about it.
Why don't you just continue and say a little bit about what you see as a family physician for many years is our sort of way of relating to death in this part of the world. How do we do that or not do that?
Well, I think, especially in view of all the advances that medicine has made possible in keeping people alive, we kind of think wrongly that we can live forever. And it's also been medicalized. It's been taken away from the home and, well, I mean...
A personal experience.
A personal experience. Yeah. And so it's changed. I mean, whereas it's become more remote. I mean, when my grandmother died, I was in back in Italy. I was in the home. The mm-hmm. family was around. Now mm-hmm. a lot of the deaths occur in hospitals or... Okay. Facilities, which, you know, some of them, like long-term care, would be the home of that patient or that person.
But more it's not their personal less, home.
Yeah, but it includes the family, perhaps less. It's, it's been medicalized. It's been...
Sometimes sanitized, it seems
sanitized
like.
As well.
You don't have to be an expert in death to have an understanding or a feeling of how people relate to it. Kathy... How do you see in the community that people kind of connect to the notion of death?
I think that there's a lack of education towards it. And I think that as in my experience with my family, it was something that wasn't openly discussed. And so when the time came to start dealing with death and the approach of my parents aging, that became a real issue that we, one, didn't know where to reach out. And it was a challenge in order to be able to find access to the medical field and stuff that we needed at the time because we hadn't prepared for it. And so it was like you're under stress, and then all of a sudden you've got this extra
experience
going on, and everybody's kind of floundering. And so it made it that much more difficult. But had I known in the front end and been more prepared, I would have certainly moved forward in a different direction and experienced the challenges a lot better.
Yeah. Janae, you're immersed in a clinical world where death is never really far away. Apart from what you see in your work, what's your general overall sense of how we... collectively reflect on death or think about it or don't think about it?
Being in this line of work, we do have multiple exposures to end of life, palliative care, sudden deaths or chronic deaths. However, I've come to know that the topic of death and dying remains taboo in our community. And my experience in education had given me the opportunity to have multiple exposures to it. And so when I speak about it openly and comfortably. But when I am in conversations with the community, it's evident that it is not a comfortable topic and it's not yet something that is celebrated where it really should be.
So when you're not at work, do the people in your life or the places where you go and socialize, does it come up? In any, not an organized way, but just as a sort of, oh, somebody died and what's that like and how are we thinking about it? And
so, like, you know, I wouldn't say that I've had natural conversations about death and dying outside of my clinical setting. Usually it's something that I would bring forward in a conversation to understand people's perspectives, experience, really what's required in our community to facilitate a further understanding of death and dying. But it is certainly not a normalized topic. It's not something that my husband would just randomly bring up in a conversation.
No, I think there are many spouses in this represented in this room where that just isn't the kind of conversation that takes place. Have any of you dealt with people from other cultures where you've sensed a somewhat different? You mentioned in Italy, there was a cultural phenomenon, Adele.
That was way back in the 50s.
Yeah. And nowadays it would be more like what we're talking about, this kind of don't talk about it, don't think about it, unless you really have to.
Unless you really have to, which is, unfortunately, when you're in a crisis, it adds to the crisis immensely.
Sure.
And it takes away from being sort of fully present, I suppose. Yeah.
Janae, you lived in other parts of the world besides here. Did you ever get a sense of what was going on in terms of death, or was it in South Africa or other places?
Yeah, you know, there is multiple different cultures in South Africa and multiple different ways of approaching death. I did do some volunteering during my senior years in high school, and I was exposed to some celebrations of death in that community, and it was pretty profound. You know, it was the biggest thing that I took from that experience was the fact that death was celebrated. It was an honor. It was an honor for people to attend the celebration. People went out of their way. They canceled events. They showed up. The whole family showed up. Everybody was dancing and cheering and celebrating and singing together. And I think that might have been a spark for me to really understand why in our Western society, we do not approach death the same way.
And when you were getting into clinical nursing and that kind of thing, you would have kind of had this in the back of your mind that there was a way to approach death that was not, you know, with a long face and feeling down and, you know, kind of the Irish wake spread around the world.
For sure. I would say that epiphany came to me when my grandma was dying in South Africa. I was in the midst of my nursing school here in Canada, and I went back to see her right away, you just for a last moment to say goodbye. And her death was not as celebrated, and it was actually quite traumatic. And that's really where my passion for palliative care came from, because I had understood and I experienced this beautiful opportunity to pass away and to have this celebrated death, and then having this personal experience where it was the opposite, and vowing to myself that I would do what I can to support celebrated transitions out of this lifetime.
Speaking of transitions, which is an important thing in our healthcare culture, there's a transition from we're going to try and make this better to we know we can't make it better. We're going to have to try and make you as comfortable as possible. Kathy, I'm going to ask you about your experience with your mother, because it was a very important experience for you, and I think is very relevant to our discussion. But I'm thinking of my two health professional colleagues here. This whole notion of, Adele, when you're going from somebody's got a disease, say a cancer, and you're trying desperately to sort of push it away, or the healthcare system in general is trying to do that, and then there's a point where you realize it can't be done, it's not working. Does that interface between those two phases sometimes get a bit perplexing, or is it?
I think it's a very difficult time, because you have to have that very difficult conversation about a life-limiting illness, and we are facing our mortality, right? But all said and done, I mean, when a cure is no longer possible and you become palliative, which means basically trying to live as well as possible until your last breath, the relationship changes somewhat, and it can be very, very rewarding and valuable time for both the patient dying, the family around them, and whoever is involved in the care of that person.
Did patients ever say to you or express a fear that you were deserting them, or that they're going to be on their own, or no longer is there an attempt to make things better, it's making things comfortable?
The fear is there, but it's up to us as caregivers to dispel that fear. And there is a lot of care that can be given, even though a cure is no longer possible.
Sure.
And in actual fact, people who access good palliative care also live longer than the expected.
Absolutely.
And it's a care that not only helps the person dying, but the people, the survivors, the family, the loved ones around them. So you're not just treating the patient, you're treating the whole.
And Janae, I see your head nodding. What would you like to add to what Adele is saying?
Well, you know, I totally agree with that. And we previously spoke about patient-centered care, and then we divulged the concept of person-centered care. And I think that's really where this is going, because if we address and approach care and palliative care and end of life in the fashion that is truly person-centered, we would be able to touch on all those pieces. We would be able to acknowledge the concerns, the fears with the family, with the patient, without the family, if that's the patient's wishes.
Sure.
At the end of the day, that approach would help us be successful in serving what the person deserves.
Sure.
Unfortunately, I do think that we're quite far away from that.
Kathy, this process that your mother went through at the end of her life was there were some good things and some bad things, but what was the transition like for you as consumer of the healthcare system, if you like, as somebody who is interacting with the healthcare system because of something is happening in somebody you care about. What was the transition like for you and for your mother when somebody said, well, there's nothing further we can do?
I think at first you're in you feel like you've been gobsmacked or you're in a bit of a shock state, and then you kind of get your focus back in line. And I think part of it too was in my particular family, death was never openly discussed. And so when the changes started to happen, it was like trying to deal with the now as opposed to being prepared. So then you're trying to initially set up home support for my mom. And then that...
Very practical stuff.
Yeah, and that was a challenge at first because I was unfamiliar with it and just getting some guidance in that term. And then once that became complicated, then we moved my mom to my home and proceeded from there until she was no longer able to. And then she became hospitalized and then transferred to a long-term care facility. But it was very challenging trying to understand the process because it was a first time for me. And it had some good points and some bad points.
Did you find some areas of the system, I'm going to call it system, but it's of course people, mm-hmm. went more smoothly than others? Were there some contacts that you had where you said, oh, this is moving the whole thing forward to understand things better, this is helping me navigate the system, and others where you just were at a loss or the information was just too sort of blunt and not nuanced enough that you could really...
I think initially when when you're initially starting out, let's say you go into a hospital transition, mm-hmm. I found that a bit challenging because their position is to find another place for your parent or your person. So they're trying to move things along without knowing 100% that you're going to be set up for support. They just want to move you to a home or to back to your home so that it frees up another bed for the next person that needs care. And that's normalized.
But this is a very important topic, the whole notion of staffing and who's available and where. And we have to talk about that because that's something that affects sort of the whole system from top to bottom. But at least this transition process from treatment to palliation is something that actually for the longest time was never addressed. I was involved with the first palliative care unit in a hospital in the world, actually. It was in Montreal. The palliative care service was run at the Royal Victoria Hospital, Balfour Mount. Dr. Balfour Mount was the guy who was the coordinator. And actually, he coined the term palliative care. Before that, there was hospice care, there was care for people who are dying. But palliative care as a term for a sort of discipline, and now it is a discipline with courses and workshops and all that kind of stuff. And that was in the 70s. And one of the reasons that it was set up at the Royal Victoria Hospital was that a survey was done looking at individuals where this transition from active care to, sorry, well, there's nothing further we can do, you're going to probably die from this illness, that transition was very badly handled. And in fact, what happened was when people were designated as what we now call palliative, the care was withdrawn. It was like, sorry, there's nothing further we can do. And it wasn't exactly goodbye, but it was, you're on your own. Things like a doctor coming to the door where the patient was in a four-bed room and say, hi, how are you doing? And the patient would start to answer, say, okay, that's great, got to go. And that kind of experience was really traumatic for many, many people. And palliative care was an attempt to make sure that didn't happen to everybody. When did each of you learn the term palliative care? Adele, you were embedded in the system some years ago.
Yeah.
Do you remember when the notion of palliative care became official, as it were?
Well, I mean, it all started for me with Kubler-Ross, with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and her...
Who wrote On Death and Dying.
On Death and Dying, yes. And how you can live as well as, you know, in a holistic sort of way when your symptoms are well managed, there can be growth for all attending. There can be love. There can, you know, it can be a beautiful experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the way, that's the goal.
So you read the book? You read the book? Do you remember reading it?
A long time back.
Yeah.
I probably don't remember half of it by now.
But when you read it, how did it strike you, like as a person working in the system?
Well, I thought that was the way to be. That was you know, that everybody would emotionally grow if that was the kind of situation you were in, and it would go a long way in the after, in the people, the survivors, the loved ones. It would go a long way knowing that you were there in that complete, total presence, and it would go a long way with the grief journey that we were left
with.
And
huge.
It would be a very comforting approach. Yeah.
Kathy, before your mom got ill, did you even know the term?
Absolutely not. It wasn't in my vocabulary. Mm. It was something that I didn't understand. I think palliative meant death, like the last final days, and just like hospice meant end of time, like, you know, that was a short term. I didn't understand the full meaning of what palliative meant, so it was very much a learning curve. And
when you first heard about it, did it seem like it was sort of backing away from caring for your mother? Did it seem like not actively caring for your mom?
No, I think the first time I heard the term was when they came to the house to do an assessment of my mom. And then it started the whole package. It was about an hour and a half interview. And then they said, you know, she was going to be deemed palliative. And then it was like, oh, but she's not actively dying. She's still got lots of life in her. And the light finally came on. And I'm like, palliative doesn't mean it's the final days. It means she's, you know.
Nobody's trying to cure her.
Right. We're just going to make her life comfortable and not, you know, as comfortable and live the best possible life she can for what she has remaining. Mm-hmm. And that's when I really started to understand what palliative. And then, so then you start, like I read, you know, about Kubler-Ross and hospice, and then it just sets you on a whole other journey of understanding what death actually means.
Janae, you and palliative care.
Well, I do have a really strong passion for palliative care, and I'm sitting here unpacking my experiences in my life of how I got here. In high school, even elementary school, I was exposed to conversations about death and dying, being from a religious background, and attending church and being a leader in church. And what does that mean for our community? How do we support community through transition? But in terms of the concept, I think it would be a similar personal experience with my grandma dying that I really first understood or heard or was exposed to the notion of palliative care in the concept of withdrawing medical care and switching to comfort care.
And this was well before you began nursing training.
That's right. That's right.
How old were you at the time? Roughly.
I would say 16, 17. It was interesting to be exposed to those concepts. And I think, again, I had two different experiences with my grandma's passing. My one grandma had passed, and that was the first one at the 16, 17 year mark, had passed in a beautiful setting, very comfortable, beautiful palliative care. And then my grandma, then later on, when I was in nursing school, my other grandma passed away in like the opposite circumstances. So again, having this black and white visual representation or experience of how starkly different it could be even within the same country. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's just, again, reiterating that there's opportunity for improvement. If something can be so beautiful, but so traumatic in a different setting, just because of resources, mm-hmm. why? Why are we not bridging that gap?
Was there also a difference in attitude among some of the people who were involved in the process for both your grandmothers?
Well, it's like it's private versus public healthcare in South Africa. And so the one setting you're paying for your healthcare and you pay for the services that you get. And that's the truth for the public healthcare as well. You pay for the services that you get. And I do not feel that your end-of-life journey should be dependent on what you can pay.
Yes, yes. I hope we have some American listeners to this show, because that's a huge issue south of the border. Maybe, Kathy, it's time for us to hear the story of your mother's experience through the palliative care, active palliative care, if I can call it that, process, because it was, as you said earlier, it had some good parts and some not so good parts. And it really had a shaping effect in terms of your understanding of things.
My mom became palliative at her home. It was shortly after my dad had passed away. And
what was her diagnosis at that point?
She had dementia, and that was basically, there was no other life-altering illnesses or anything.
But it was moving quickly?
It was very aggressive and very quick by the time we noticed it. But being parents, when I had a father and a mother, my dad protected my mom, so she was having a lot of TIAs, and no wonder her driving was atrocious, because she was probably having little mini strokes, and they were trying to keep their being able to stay at home, so they were covering for each other. So by the time we noticed it when my dad passed, that, wow, there's something wrong with my mom. Like,
and it gets confused easily and that kind of stuff.
Yes, yes. So she then moved to Salmon Arm, and we... following that, we started with the home support, and that became a bit challenging because the system didn't have enough home support for what was required for. And so then I brought her to our home, and we did that for a while until she became a full lift, and I wasn't able to...
So physically, it wasn't just... mental changes, it was also physical changes as well.
Also physical changes. And then following that, she was went to the hospital, and then we went to long-term care. That long-term care also hit just when COVID was there.
Mm.
So that became exceptionally challenging because of visitation and just the nursing, the amount of staff that was available. So I would go every day to help feed her and stuff, but
it was... So you became actively involved in your care, even in the institutional setting?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm. I know they didn't want me more than 3 times a week, but I refused and went anyway.
Well, yes, isn't that an interesting phenomenon when you're at this very vulnerable point in your life? And there are many stories about this from the pandemic, that people actually, in some cases, died because they became socially isolated. They lost that sense of community and connection with their family and that kind of thing. So there you were every day in against the sort of rules, but nevertheless in tune with the rules of human behavior and value.
Yes, but I also saw what was happening in the rest of the facility, like the amount of people that were left there. Some had family, some didn't have family, and it was like I missed my calling. I loved them all. I wanted to help them all. And it was just amazing to see how many people were being left alone and not having that extra hug or attention that they needed. And also at that time, you had to wear masks and everything else. So
your mom was declining throughout this as well. And quite quickly.
Yes, she was less, I think, about 10 months in the facility. And it became quite aggressive to where at the end she wasn't eating anymore or anything. And then it just all happened. I got the call that she's not getting up anymore. Her breathing is changing. We think today might be, you should come in earlier. And so I did. The process was, because I'm Catholic and we were raised, we had her last rites read and a few days before, because I could see her declining. And then during the process, it was about 12 hours of just her breathing and everything changing until...
But and you stayed there the whole time?
Absolutely. My sister
And nobody
came.
Made a fuss about it
no,
at that point?
No, we were...
Good.
It was a,
that was good.
Yeah. No, it was in you know, the rooms aren't that big, but we were able to sit there with her. And I welcomed her to go on her next journey. It was time. And I had a better understanding of that now, because I didn't want her to be here anymore in the circumstances that she was.
How did the people around you, the clinical people, the staff people, and all of the other people involved, how did that pan out?
They were very kind and you know, they just knock on the door every once in a while and say, is everything okay? Is there anything we can get you, a glass of water or whatever? But they were there, but it was also, you just weren't disturbed. It was our final leg of the journey, and they were just very respectful of the space.
You said there were some parts that weren't so good. What would you include under that heading?
I think the first one that I met with was just trying to work my way through the system sometimes and having the supports. I understand that when you're in the hospital, they want to free up that bed. You know, somebody gave that bed up for you. Now you need to give it up for somebody else. Mm. So we need to help move you along. But not having the supports in place when you go home, they say they are. But as soon as you get home, it's like, whoa.
They're not there 24/7.
No, they're not there 24/7, and you need 24/7 sometimes. That was one of the biggest challenges I met. And then when my mom became a full lift, that was a two-man support system at home. Well, they couldn't even keep up with one. How were they going to show up with two? That was a complete disaster. And so then I took her home, and then the last and the biggest challenge was dealing with COVID. And I know everybody struggled with that as to what was permitted and what wasn't permitted. I wasn't allowed to be in the dining room. I wasn't, you know, we had to eat in a room. Like there was no, they didn't want you in the public. And so there was a lot of restricted access for family to be able to integrate with other people and having those conversations. So they felt, I fought quite isolated.
As your mother was literally losing her mind, how long through this process were you able to sort of connect to her in a way that she kind of knew who you were? Whether she could remember your name is not so relevant, but she kind of knew.
I would say up until about the last 10 days. Mm. And so she was vividly aware because I went every day and did her hair and dressed her up with jewelry and made her look nice because that was always very important in her life. And we'd do the photo albums with family and talk about what was going on and review. And it was just, yeah, about the last 10 days that she wasn't verbally able to speak much. And it was just like this little fog had gone in front of her.
Clouding her vision.
Yes, in her memory.
So we're talking about palliative care, and there was for the longest time a notion that it was kind of a different kind of care. It really is sort of based on the basic principle that you want to be kind to people and bring them as much comfort and sense of security as they decline as possible. Adele, when you're listening to Kathy talk, when would you say you really saw palliative care, not just as a concept, you know, an idea? Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's book, she was a psychiatrist and talked to people who were dying, said, what's it like? And constructed, you know, this system, which is quite accurate about loss and the stages of grief and that kind of thing. When did you see it really happening in hospitals, that people were really taking this seriously as a separate but included discipline, if you like?
It's a hard one to...
Well, it wasn't going to be an overnight thing. No.
All I can say is that in 2012, end-of-life care was recognized as an area of care that needed attention. And so a whole process started, medical staff-led.
Change of
project. And IHA was involved, community was involved, there was a patient representative, mm-hmm. hospice was involved, and he came up with recommendations. And the recommendations were that it should be a team approach where the team would comprise of physicians, nurses, social worker, hospice, pharmacy, in dealing with the care, how to deliver the care, how best to deliver the care. And all those recommendations were accepted. The recommendation also included having dedicated space and staff that were appropriately trained and culturally informed, and mm-hmm. to make the experience as holistic and as supportive as possible. Mm-hmm. And we got most of that. And then in 2018, they actually developed a palliative care team, which meant the same faces mm-hmm. being supporting people at home. Sure. And that went a long way, I think, to help mm-hmm. to make the service, the delivery better.
It's interesting because I was working in palliative care in the 70s, mm. and the model was there, and it was developed pretty quickly because you learned things that you could do and things you couldn't do. You don't do a lot of diagnostic testing in people, and yet the system kind of kept on doing testing all the time. It's interesting to see that it would take, you know, 30 or 40 years between the fully developed concept and its spreading throughout the healthcare system. Now, you came later, Janae. Was palliative care already introduced in your initial training as a nurse? It was a presence there as well?
Yeah, you know, palliative care was grouped in with geriatric care, which in hindsight I don't really agree with, because palliative care
can be dying at all ages.
Exactly. It's not just one demographic. However, we did learn about it in nursing school. There was quite a big focus on patient-centered care, maybe not person-centered, but patient-centered for sure. You know, and there was definitely growth and in exposure there for us as well, where we did practicums either in community, long-term care, or even the acute care setting, where we were exposed to palliative care. And not everyone had that exposure, but I certainly sought it out.
I was going to say, did you seek it out?
I did.
I sought it out in medical school. I did a rotation in palliative care unit when I was still a medical student.
And
seemed like a good place to be.
Totally. And, you know, it really reminded me of, because we were talking about childhood experiences, and I was like, no, there's something else that set this off for me. And as we're talking, I recalled my favorite movie of all time, which is Patch Adams. And Robin Williams was the lead actor in that. And I remember watching that movie pretty much annually for like 7 years in a row during my developing years in my childhood. And, you know, now we're having this conversation and I can see how much of that movie actually formed my thought processes and my approach to care.
What did it do? Did it make it a good thing? Did it make it something that was really, we think about death often as sort of a negative thing, which is ridiculous, but we do think that way. And this gave you a sort of sense of that, recapturing some of the joy that you talked about when your first grandmother died.
Yes, yes, very much so. You know, it was such a celebration, that movie, such a celebration of like your last, essentially what it is about is like, how can we make your last living time the best time of your life? Or what is your last wish and how can we help you get there? And to me, that is like the most person-centered focus, because you're giving someone the opportunity to have one last hurrah. And in
I
my
love that. One last hurrah.
Yeah, and in my lifetime, I've actually had the opportunity to participate in that with mm-hmm. someone, where I volunteered in the Langley Hospital before I went into nursing. And there was a patient in the hospital there who had a stroke. She had essentially became a long-term patient, and she had no use of the one side of her body. But I did have this, like, I was gravitated towards her. And I asked her, what is one thing that you wish you could do throughout your life? And she explained that she wished she was a painter. And me at that time, prepping to go into nursing school, I recognized that she probably doesn't have sight in one side of her eye. And so every second or third day for pretty much a month and a half, I went to go visit her and I would paint one half of the painting. And I would spin the painting and then she would understand that that was actually her work that she was doing and she was helping. And we did it until the painting was done.
What was the painting of?
It was a flower.
It was
her favorite flower. At the end of the time, you know, a month and a half later, that it was done and we put it on her wall and she was so proud. She was so proud of this work that she did. But the most memorable part of that experience was the nurses coming in and out, celebrating her. Mm. Every second day I was there, they came in, they stood by her, they celebrated with her for this work that she was doing. And to me, that is really the final reason why I became a nurse.
Now, one of the things that we didn't talk much before we did the recording today, but that is the fact that the manner of death has changed a lot in our world. Specifically, the development of antibiotics, for example, has meant that people spend a lot longer going through the decline process than they once did. The classic death, and your grandmother, you get an infection, some part of your body gets involved, and typically death can be weeks, maybe a month, maybe 6 weeks. The process of going from being fully alive to being, you know, dead was much more precipitous than it is now. And in by the 1980s, in fact, this had changed quite radically. Almost everybody was dying at a much slower pace, meaning you'd have this, you know, incremental loss of function and capacity. And that would mean a lot more demands on, say, family and friends, because in many cultures, family and friends do all of the care for somebody who's getting ill and then dying. Can any of you, and specifically I'm going to look at you, Adele, because you would have seen an era when antibiotics were coming on, and they were already pretty widespread. But you probably would have remembered days when they weren't available.
Mm-hmm.
I got some of the first ugly penicillin pills that you can imagine.
It was sulfonamide in my days.
Oh, yes. Oh, well, there you are.
Before penicillin.
Yeah.
So, you know, before antibiotics and, you know, I guess, turn of the century, death was still... medicine couldn't do that much about keeping people alive, say, with a sepsis or with even trauma. And pneumonia actually was the best friend.
Old person's friend.
With the advent of antibiotics and transfusions and all the developments that happened in the last 75 years now, we almost came to believe that we could live forever, that, you know, we could hold off death. And so we came to feel about death as a failure, as our failure of not being able to keep people alive. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, needs to change, because you do want to help people live as long as possible, but you also want them to have some quality.
Yes.
And so nowadays, I think we are trying to relook at that and say, what is really, you know, when you deliver care, when you're at the point that a cure is no longer possible, then what is really important about in the care that you deliver? And that is the spiritual, the emotional, the palliation of symptoms and comfort.
The issue that I think we need to talk about a little bit is when you have an attitude towards death that doesn't respect it and the meaning of it and the importance of it and the importance of living, as you just described, Janae, till the very end, then you don't give the services. You don't make the services as complete as they should be for people who are in that state. And because death now is more likely to happen to people who are old, you know, our life expectancy has changed quite dramatically. And so you can live to be 80 fairly predictably. Staffing, I'll just talk about staffing, because how many people are doing a job is what staffing means. That's a fancy word, but it means how many people are available to accomplish a task. And you've worked in both acute care, Janae, and chronic or long-term care. And there's often a stark difference between how much importance we give to acute care versus long-term care. Why don't you talk about staffing and what kind of issues you see arising, because you're immersed in this on a regular basis?
I think it's widely known that healthcare is understaffed at this time, regardless of the sector. Most recently, in May of 2025, acute care was able to secure additional staffing through BCCNM, which is their regulatory body, and the union, for safe patient ratios. However, those safe patient ratios have not been implemented in long-term care or residential care, and we actually have not been advised as how those safe ratios would even look. To me, it's also widely known that our geriatric demographic is going to outweigh our younger population. Specifically, we were taught that in nursing school, that we are to prepare for this time. However, we're in this time and we're not prepared. And we do not have the services and resources that are required for our geriatric populations. And that is something that I'm very passionate about. And what I specifically mean by that is that, you know, if we see regular ratios in acute care, specifically, let's use the med-surg ward, of a ratio from 1 to 4 on your average, 1 to 6, a little higher up, 1 to 7, that's getting up there. Accepted ratios in long-term care vary, and our government really needs to look at that. So at times, one nurse is responsible for 40 different residents. And because our populations are aging, not the same way that it did historically, people are living longer with more complex chronic conditions, which means that they do need more supervisory care, they need more medical care, they need more support, they need more hours. And so what that means is that the requirement for, hours to be spent physically from our healthcare sector is severely under what is currently required, which means that people's needs are not being met.
There was a couple of reports that came out, I think 2017, 2023, on staffing and the kind of amount of care you offer to people in different situations. And that's where the long-term care side was not actually completed. It's mentioned, but it's not being completed.
That's right. The recommendation came out from the Ministry of Health. However, it's a recommendation. And so those recommendations were prioritized for acute care in 2025, which is great. I am so grateful for that. And I'm sure our whole community is grateful for that. However, there's a whole nother demographic that needs support, and it doesn't need support in 5 years or 10 years. It needs support now. It needs support now. We are burning out a whole sector of people that is trying to give our deserving seniors the care that they long for and safely require. Mm-hmm. That then becomes more complicated when we are in residential care or even acute care, and we have patients that are now actively palliating. It is known that in the medical community that when someone is actively palliating, that they
meaning they need specific kinds of care to be comfortable, to be able to function.
That's right. So, we can give examples for that. So when we say we want to keep someone comfortable, and if they're in pain, mm-hmm. we want to make sure that they're getting regular pain medications. And sometimes that can be every hour or even every 30 minutes. If you have competing demands, regardless of the sector that you're in, there's often times that if there's life-saving measures required, that's going to be prioritized over someone's comfort when dying. And that's not appropriate.
I'm going to raise a word, and Kathy, I know you're going to respond to this word because it's something close to your heart. It's Burzorg. Now, we don't have to talk about Burzorg yet, but it's a system that's been developed in the Netherlands. The concept there is to give the caregivers complete control over what they do. And says you meet the needs of your patients, clients, whatever you call them, in the way you think best. And that is something that you're talking about, Janae. Just it doesn't happen. There's directives that come from a central government, and they're sometimes relevant. And the parts that are left out, in a way, express a value or a lack of valuing people who are old, worn out, falling apart. It's like, sorry, we're going to look after the people who are young and fit and need surgery right away because of, gallbladder or something like that. But just give a little bit of an insight into the Burzorg model. For example, it allows people to die at home far more often than happens in our part of the world. This Dutch system that's being evolved and is working around the world. Just give the gist of what's part of it, because you really fell onto this.
I fell onto it probably because I am Dutch. My background is Dutch, and they always seem to have this. But boer means a neighborhood, and hort is a house. So it's a neighborhood house is what it stands for. And the concept is where you gather a group of clients, and then there's the care that's provided. And I've been watching some of these TED Talks after you mentioned the name, and I've got passionately divulged in it because I always thought I wanted to see a neighborhood where we had a little village, which is another concept in Europe, sure, where you have a village where dementia people can come and they can cut their hair and go to the grocery store and buy, and they live a life that's honored in a village where they still feel they offer value. And so this new concept that started in the nursing care system just makes so much more sense. And, you know, as a taxpayer, I look at 97% success ratio from the family, the caregivers, the lack of people resigning from the jobs, like caregiver burnout. Everybody jumps on board and they're all encased in this whole thing and everybody's happy. And so I think it's a great concept.
One of the key concepts here is that caregivers make decisions about what kind of care they will give. It's not interfered with, if you want to call it that, by administrators who do not directly have an involvement in patient care. I want to just go back to what you were saying, Janae, about an experience you had in acute care with a patient who was actively heading towards death. And you just didn't have enough people to be with him. Why don't you talk about it? He was the guy in the corridor that you mentioned, because I think it's an illustration of the kind of issue we're kind of moving towards right now.
Yeah, so I would just like to start by saying that this was an exceptionally challenging night. This was also before the ratios changed and some further changes were made to our current acute care sector. That specific night, it was quite difficult to manage the workload. We had overflow patients. We were watching patients in multiple different sectors with very, very limited staffing. During that time, we had a palliative patient who really just needed someone to sit with him.
He was scared.
He was scared, and he was verbally asking for us to remain with him so that he's not alone. However, given our workload and the other acute pieces that were going on that night, we were not able to sit with him. We were not able to maintain constant contact. We were checking on him as much as we could. However, we were running back and forth. We just did not have the ability to sit with him. And that was extremely difficult for me as an individual, sure, as a nurse, as a practitioner. And so much so that I got pulled away so often, and I was so concerned about this man and him being alone. And at one point I just saw him reaching out to me, and I'd taken his hand for just a second. I could hear my alarms going off. I need to tend to them. They're acute alarms. I need to go check what's going on. But this man just held my hand and he just asked, please just stay with me. Please don't let me go. I can't be alone. I don't want to be alone. I had to let go. We were three nurses working that night, and all of us made turns to be with him as much as we could. At one point, my heart just broke because he wouldn't let go of my hand, but I had to go. And I was so concerned that I was going to come back and he had passed alone. When I came back, my colleague had placed him in the hallway, and she was doing her charting next to him, just so that he wouldn't be alone. And that gave us the opportunity to be with him as much as we could. Even though he was in the hallway, we were running back and forth, but he saw us. He was alone, but he wasn't alone. That situation both gave me hope, but also broke my heart. It's one of the hardest experiences I've had, when someone literally just wants you to hold their hand, and you cannot.
And, you know, holding somebody's hand, we have such narrow perceptions of what human contact is all about. There is an energy contained in a human hand, and there's an energy contained in all of us that is not the same as a machine, is not the same as a chemical. And Adele, Yes, you have something.
I just want to add and point out that end-of-life care is human-intense and
yes.
technology relatively poor. We may need technology to get the best possible palliation of symptoms,
yes.
but it's a people connection that goes far beyond anything else.
And you've raised an issue that, in my notes, I made it as the final issue to talk about, and that is that it's about relationship. Palliative care is about relationship, one person relating to another person. It doesn't mean you've known them all your life. It means that they are alive, they care, and they join you in your journey right there in their space.
And I think relationship take a while to develop. And I think this is where you want the same people, not a procession of new faces coming to
Indeed.
Help. But in the, and I think the palliative care team that we have in our community now
yes,
is doing just that.
That's right.
And it's a huge step in the right direction.
It's the kind of thing, you know, Kathy, you talked about how hard it was during the pandemic, that the relationships, there was the gear that you had to wear and it cut you off from people, but also you couldn't be in certain places at certain times. And your story, Janae, is, I mean, I think all of us felt how hard that was for you, for that person who was dying, and how you actually, one of your staff colleagues, improvised and said, oh, I'm going to do my charting right out in the middle of the corridor. Now, probably somebody in an administrative position might have said, well, you know, this is exposing, you know, private personal records to, you know, scrutiny from places you're not supposed. Did any flack occur because of it, or did it never get reported?
I would say that it was another day. It was another day in healthcare.
Yes.
Nobody batted an eye. It was, you know, the nurses that was working that night did have a bit of a debrief and mostly just a conversation. And I thank that nurse and I thank each of those, like the mm-hmm. other nurse as well,
yes.
For being able to carry the weight of what that night was. And we moved on. It's just another day. It is just another day in healthcare.
I want to thank you, all three of you, Adele, Kathy, and Janae, for being with us here today. We've had a discussion that I think is about one of the central aspects of all lives, which is what happens when they come to an end. And each of you has your own perspective, your own experience. I do hope, one thing I would say at the end is I do hope the Boerdsorf model from Holland gets taken seriously because, and I, listeners, I'm telling you, there's nodding heads in this whole table because that kind of continuity of care, that kind of the familiarity, the relationship between caregiver and care receiver developing over time and becoming full and complete as people, complicated as we are, get to know each other. I think that is an answer to making death an experience that is can be welcomed in its own way and celebrated in its own way as well. Thank you all for being here today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.